Welcome to This Is Money podcast. I'm Georgie Frost, and alongside me and editor Simon Lambert today is assistant editor Lee Boyce. And coming up, ministers want us to turn our houses green to save the planet, but do the sums add up for cash-strapped homeowners? Meanwhile, Simon takes aim at London's low-emission zone expansion. It's less than 3 months away, and it's riddled with inconsistencies. Also today, value and quality are in, income and momentum are out. We explain the latest investing trends and bust some jargon along the way. Tesco closes all of its current accounts, so where next for their nearly a quarter of a million customers? Barclays, maybe? You can now earn Avios points and get a free upgrade once a year. So what's the catch? Don't forget, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. But first, the government is on a mission to make our homes more green, arguing that domestic energy use accounts for about 14% of the UK's greenhouse gas emissions. Now, it's all part of a drive for the country to hit net zero emissions by 2050. The intentions are ultimately worthy, better for the environment, and therefore, I guess it figures better for our wallets. The former may be true, the latter, I'm not so sure. Let's just take a wee look. Underfloor insulation, set you back about $5,000, double glazing, another $5,000 on top, solar panels perhaps, $6,000 to $7,000. Wall insulation, well, there you're looking about £10,000. Heat pumps, oof, £20,000. Lee, not cheap, is it, when you look at this? Let's take a look. Let's go back. What are the government's aims here? You know, what methods are they using to get there? Let's take a look at some of the bans, some of the incentives.
Well, the government is on this real drive. You know, it's been on this green push for the last couple of years, and that boils down to a lot of things. It boils down to the whole households, businesses, all different areas of our lives. The thing is, I'm a bit sceptical about some of this stuff, and especially this part of it all. So let's think back to last year. We had this green scheme. We basically, household could apply for funding to get some green improvements done around their homes. That was pulled pretty quickly. Not many people got to take advantage of that. And it actually felt like something that could have been useful, but it was just really sort of botched and it just didn't quite work right. Now, the government is talking about, you know, households taking responsibility here and making things greener. So making your EPC rating better than it currently is. That's a scale of A to G of how energy efficient your home is. Now, the average home in Britain is a D, so it's in the middle. It wants all homes to be a C or above. We've seen this push in recent times. The thing is with it, is it's expensive to push your house up a band. Lots of Britain's housing stock is old. Lots of it's built Victorian times. Very difficult to go in and make improvements in those types of homes. In some instances, you probably have to pull the home down and rebuild it in order to make it energy efficient. You know, it's not easy. Lots of rural properties as well. You know, it's just very difficult to get your home up a notch, and it's very expensive. We did a story a little while back about landlords exiting the market because homes have to be over a certain standard, and that's coming in, you know, that's been slowly trickling in. We've had stories about mortgage lenders offering preferential rates to people that are buying a home that's C rated or above. There's all these little incentives out there, but the real long and short of it is things like heat pumps to replace a gas boiler are incredibly expensive. And the government has wised up this week, and it looks like it's going to push back this deadline for people to not be able to install new gas boilers because it's so expensive. We've got a case study in the story this week. You know, bought a new home, wanted to make it green, wanted to get the credentials of the home to make it greener. And then a builder came around and had a look, and was like, you know, you're going to have to pull up all your flooring to have a heat pump, and have you got a spare $20,000 to do it? You know, and that's the thing. Like, you know, you can push people towards having this kind of stuff. The government has a target of installing 600,000 heat pumps a year, for example.
At 20 grand a pop,
and at the moment it's running at about 25,000. But the long and short of it is, people go, you know, that's just too much money. You know, to throw at something that's going to not save you that much money a year. You're probably, depending on how long you're planning to live in a home, you're unlikely to ever wipe out that upfront cost, let alone all of the drama of having to have everything pulled up. Heat pumps, by the way, more popular in continental Europe. It basically just pulls in air electricity heats up a coil and it just pushes out to basically heat your home with electricity rather than gas. But unless you're building, if you're building a new home and you build this into it, yeah, that makes total sense. And perhaps for something like a new build home, it might make more sense because you're designing it with these green features in mind. And that probably makes more sense. New housing stock should be, there's no reason why new housing stock shouldn't be an A or B rated property. It's the people that are in, that have bought properties that are just old, and it's very, very tricky. You know, even getting things like double glazing for some people is tricky. You know, double glazing is great if you can get it, but not everyone can get it. And I think that's the trouble. That there was a report, I think, from Rightmove last month suggesting that there was something like 1 million homes or 1.5 million homes that could just never become C rated. So what do you do for those homes? Do you just pull them down and start again? So it's one of those things. It's too broad at the moment. It's too broad, and it needs to be narrowed down how it's going to tackle this. And actually, when you're saying 14%, it doesn't actually sound like an awful large chunk to me. You know, how much are you going to be able to reduce that by realistically? How much are people going to have to front the bill? There's too many questions, Georgie, and I think it just feels like there's not enough detail on how to make this happen properly at the moment. It needs to be, if you're going to make people get heat pumps, yeah, then you're going to have to find a way of making it accessible and affordable for people to do it. You can't expect people to pay £20,000 to get one, rip up their floor. You know, it takes time to get it in there. I just can't see it happening.
So detail to a degree, we have some, but it's like the cost is the real thing that's presumably going to hold back these plans, Simon.
100%. It all boils down to the cost and whether people could think they can make their money back and how long they think it'll take them to make their money back, or whether they'll make a bit of money on top. And you do not need anything to demonstrate that more clearly than the solar panel rush, when people rushed to put solar panels on their homes. Now, that came in two phases, one of which I would argue was better than the other one. The first phase was the government's feed-in tariffs, which actually, if you got in early, turned out to be a really great return on investment. There are people out there making 10% plus a year returns on their solar panels by selling energy back to the grid. And then the rates that you could do that at were stepped down and stepped down and stepped down. And effectively, the government tariff has, you know, all but kind of disappeared. You can still export any energy you generate, but don't use to the national grid. But that's only estimated to earn a typical homeowner about £190 a year. If you add that to the bill savings, you'd get your investment back in 20 years. Now, that's a long time. Whereas there were people who got in early on this, who were getting paid to generate, getting paid to export, and have been reaping returns of maybe 12% a year, etc., and then saving money on their bills as well. And that's great. And that is why you saw this big rush to get panels put on the roof. And the government sort of realized that maybe they've been a bit too generous, and they cut it back and they cut it back and they cut it back. And they thought that solar panels would stand on their own two feet. Now, you're still seeing people getting solar panels fitted, but not to the same extent. The second part of the solar panel thing that was not so good was, because of these payments, there was this boom in companies calling people up and offering to put solar panels on their roof for free in exchange for them getting money off their bills. Now, we always said that this was probably a bad idea, because effectively the solar panel company was taking a kind of long lease on your roof. And we pointed out that mortgage companies don't tend to look too kindly on this kind of stuff. Prospective buyers might not look too kindly on the fact that effectively you've given up your roof for X number of years and so on, just for what is effectively a very small saving on your energy bills every year. The industry that was doing this, which involved an unbelievable amount of cold calling, which gives you an indication of its sort of, you know, level of, do I want to do this worthness, insisted that people were totally wrong. We were warning people completely unnecessarily. Anyway, it turned out that, yeah, mortgage companies and prospective buyers don't like solar panels on long leases on people's roofs. But it just goes to show the way that this worked, that if people thought there was something in it for them, or it was heavily subsidized and it came down to cost, then they would do it. But with some of this other stuff, like the heat pumps and you know, some of these plans to replace boilers, I just can't see it happening because, in all honesty, we bought a house that we moved into. We're going to completely renovate it. We're going to do lots of work to it. We would potentially, other than people who are building a brand new house, be ideal candidates for doing this kind of thing. But the cost of it is just prohibitive. And we're probably not going to do it. We're going to stick with a gas boiler. I mean, maybe that'll prove to be a mistake when the government does rid us of gas boilers. But there's talk of that being pushed back because I just think that it's so difficult to retrofit this stuff into people's housing stock. And then also you have the problem of how what the makeup of the British housing stock is. We live in lots of old properties. If you lived in a country where there were lots of relatively new properties, this would be less of an issue. But we don't. We talked about this on the podcast before. People actively want to live in flats that have been in buildings that are basically over 100 years old. You know, the properties that are in demand in the largest urban centre in the country of London are the Victorian, Georgian, Edwardian properties. They aren't the new build properties. And it just can be quite difficult to make those very energy efficient. And especially when you start talking about things like solid wall insulation, because there's two types of wall insulation. Cavity wall insulation, cheap, easy to do, get your money back. Solid wall insulation, that's for older properties that don't have a cavity wall. And you either have to fit panels to the inside of the walls, which is expensive and disruptive because you need to take off the skirting boards, the plug sockets, the door frames when you do the inside. Or you have to do it outside, which requires sort of a level of insulation and then either rendering over the top or cladding it or adding like a brick facade. And people don't want to do that. I mean, if you owned a Victorian house, you would be mad to clad it, you know, in order to get some extra insulation, because all of a sudden you would have decreased the value of your nice looking Victorian house. So yeah. The ones that do pay off, loft insulation, cheap, easy, average cost £270, annual saving 180. Cavity wall insulation, average cost £475, annual savings 125. And insulating your hot water tank costs on average £35, annual saving £80. So you actually get that back quite quickly. And that is something that I should do because our hot water tank loses heat very, very rapidly. Mm. But yeah, I think there's two things intersecting here, isn't there? The government either needs to put its hand in its pocket, and that unfortunately means put us, everybody in the nation, putting their hands in their pocket. And that was it's already been a bit of a contentious issue to do with people's energy bills going up because of this, or needs to radically revise its expectations. And the problem is this all fits into our pledge to go net zero.
Lee, Simon there outlined the upgrades that can pay for themselves or that you'll get investment back, as it were. But if you had, let's say, 50 grand, Lee, and you had a choice to extend your home or to do all the bits and pieces that will make it green, it depends when you'd sell it, I guess. But in terms of investing in your property to make it more valuable in the future, will people be looking for this when they buy in the future?
I would say that more people would be keener to buy a bigger home that's got an extra room,
right,
than a home that has all singing, all dancing green credentials. That said, though, when you buy a home and you get a property survey done and you have a look at it, you know, you do get an energy report with it. And I don't envision many people look at that and go, it's only a D rating, so I'm probably not going to buy it. It does give a little snapshot, though, of potentially what could be done in the home to help make it more energy efficient. But to answer your question, Georgie, what would you rather have, an extra room, or would you rather have a slightly greener home? I mean, that's the trade-off for the same price. And most people would say an extra room. I just can't envisage people not saying that.
Well, the only thing I think of is if you think that coming down the line, we're going to get a lot of sticks from the government as opposed to carrots. In terms of, or from lenders, mortgage lenders, you know, that's the thing you'd have in the back of your mind. I mean, you're obviously not thinking that that would be an issue.
Potentially, yeah, further down the line. But I think a lot of people buy a home and they're not really thinking about 10, 15, 20 years in the future, people talk about buying a forever home. In a lot of the circumstances, it doesn't work out that way. So I don't know. It's very hard to think down the line how people and house homeowners might be penalised. I mean, obviously, as I mentioned earlier about landlords and housing stock needs to be improved, and it has made some people, that's been the catalyst to go, I'm exiting the market. So there could be, but the thing is, if you think about some of the stuff and how much it costs, you know, solid floor insulation costs $5,000. You're going to save £70 a year on average. Years to enjoy a return, 71. I mean, that is not enticing, is it? Double glazing, £4,900, and you're saving £75, 65-year return, which I'm quite surprised at. I mean, that seems like quite a long return. Mm. You know, solar water heating, £4,500. Years to enjoy return, 64. Solar panels, 6,200.
Generations. I don't mean saving money. I think about the environmentally.
Yeah, I know, but it's very hard to get, you know, especially when we're in the back of, let's say you bought a home in the last sort of 6 months. We're on the back of house prices rising and rising and rising. And a lot of people are having to kind of, you know, take a stretch on their finances to get onto the property ladder. So is your first thought once you buy a home to get all of this stuff done and over the line? I'm not convinced. And then you've got new builds that you could argue are just not built as well and are smaller and are not as good housing stock. You know, I'm not saying all new builds, but that has been the criticism for some new builds. You know, are they having all of these green credentials built into them? That's where the real opportunity lies for me. I think you have to be saying that if you're a house builder has to build a large percentage, if not all, of new homes to an A rating. There's no excuse not to. Yeah, it's more expensive to build the home. And yeah, that might mean a more expensive outlay for someone to buy it. But when you're starting from scratch, that's when to do it. If you're in an old home, you know, it's a lot of work. It's a lot of money. It's not much you're going to earn back each year, and fundamentally that's what people think about things in pounds and pence. I don't think they're really thinking about the green credentials of their home on the whole. I'm not saying that's everyone, and I'm not saying that that's right or wrong. I'm just saying that, you know, depending on where you are in your life, first time buyer, you're just happy that you've bought a home, you know, and you're going to kick the can down the road. You're a homeowner that's been in a property for 5 to 10 years, you're probably more looking at an extension or moving on because you need more space. You're someone that's owned a home for 15, 20, 25 years. You've probably already done that work.
Yeah.
You're not really keen on doing all of that, any more work to your home and having mass changes made. It's very hard to make or force people to do it. And I think that's what the government is kind of realizing by pushing potentially this gas boiler date back, for example. I think they're realizing that it's all well and good sounding off and making all these claims about figures, about, you know, emissions and all of that kind of thing. But for the average person, although they'll digest those figures, they'll then look at their own personal finances, their own individual circumstances, and go, do I want to spend this amount of money making a home a tiny bit greener, and I'm going to make a little bit back? Yeah, okay, you know, you can feel good about it and be like, I'm doing my bit, and everyone needs to be doing their bit across the country to help this happen. But on the flip side, do people really want to do it? That's what it all boils down to for me. And if people aren't incentivized properly, then it's not going to happen. And the thing is, this is what I was talking about earlier, like this green home deal that came out last year. It was actually in principle was a good idea. It's being pulled very quickly. Not many people have been able to take advantage of it. There was criticisms when it launched because there wasn't enough tradespeople to go around. Tradespeople are just momentously busy at the moment. Mm-hmm. They usually are anyway, but even more so at the moment to be able to get this work done. It just didn't make an awful lot of sense. I think that scheme, if that goes back to the drawing board and they make some tweaks and amendments to it and make it a little bit more palatable for people, that's when we will see more uptake on it. You know, something like electric car grant, you know, that's helped some people make a decision into buying an electric car. You know, there needs to be something like that for homeowners. That's my personal viewpoint. Otherwise, 99% of people, I would argue, aren't going to be thinking about doing this.
All right, then. From the carrots, the incentives, to the 2x4s. ULEZ, London's ultra-low emission zone. That's where we'll go next. Been a nice little earner for City Hall, raking in an extra £107 million in the first year it was in place. Now, in less than 3 months, it's expanding. which will leave at least 300,000 residents with older cars facing a fee of £12.50 every time they get behind the wheel and move it, not just if they sit behind the wheel and don't move it. But if you have a Bentley SUV, well, you can swank about for free, says Simon. Simon, your latest column. Explain Ulez and the expansion.
It's the ultra low emissions zone. And this is Sadiq Khan's brainwave to improve London's polluted air. A noble aim, I should state before I say anything further. Cleaning up the air that we breathe is a good idea, okay? Making our cities less polluted. There is, unfortunately, a little bit of a problem with this. Whilst I don't think many people would have an objection to the very centre of London, Sadiq is expanding Ulez all the way out to the North and South Circular. And all of a sudden you go from a zone that is effectively the congestion charge zone at the moment, which contains just central London, where there's not that many ordinary people living anymore, in all honesty. It's a shame. It'd be nice if there were more of them, but there aren't that many ordinary people living there. And they live in an area that is effectively largely within the Circle Line. And so contains most of London's, you know, tube, bus, you can walk a lot of it, easy to get around stuff, out to a large swathe of residential London, occupied by many, many normal, ordinary Londoners. And they are going to get whacked for £12.50 every day that they drive their car at any time of the day. So 24 hours a day, it will be effective. So even if you go drive your car at 3 o'clock in the morning when there's nobody else on the roads, you will be charged 364 days a year. You get Christmas off. I mean, that's nice, isn't it? Ho, ho, ho. And that adds up. If you only moved your car once a week on average, you'd pay £650 a year. If you went a little bit nuts and used your car on three different days of the week, maybe you had to use it both days of the weekend and once in the week, perhaps you have to drop the kids to breakfast club before you rush off to work. And whilst I would say London's a small place, it's best not to have to have to drive your kids to school. For realistically, it happens. When I lived in London, we used to have to drive our kids up the hill to breakfast club so that both me and my wife could get to work on time. Otherwise, we would have had to be dragging them out of the house nearly an hour earlier, okay? Which, you know, when you can just nip up the road in 5 minutes on empty roads, you know, you drop them off in the car. Yes, if you did it three times a week, it'd be £1,950 a year, which is quite a lot of money. And the people affected by this are those with petrol cars that don't meet Euro 4 standards. So that's pretty much anything that was new before 2006. And diesel cars that don't meet Euro 6 standards. And that's much more recent. That's anything pretty much that wasn't new, that was new before 2015. So only cars, generally diesel cars after 2015. And it's these latter people who feel the most aggrieved, I think, because many diesel owners fall into the bracket of people who were encouraged to buy diesel cars because they were told they were better for the planet, only to subsequently discover that they were being demonized because they pumped out nitrogen oxide, which is bad for people's health. Stuff that's bad for people's health is bad, but also stuff that's bad for the planet is bad too. So we've got this weird thing going on at the moment where we're sort of encouraging people back into petrol cars. I mean, we're saying we want them in electric cars, but basically there's just not enough of those to go around at cheap prices secondhand, and not everybody wants to buy a new car, and not everybody can afford to buy a new car. So this is where the noble aim kind of intersects with the worst thing about the policy. It is effectively a deeply regressive tax on people having a car, and it uses a sledgehammer to crack a nut. Because while a family driving a 10-year-old diesel Nissan Qashqai around have to pay £12.50 every time and may not be able to afford to replace it, that might, you know, that might be worth £4,000, and they might have to find another £4,000 to replace it with a car that meets Ulez that fits them in, etc., etc. If you own a brand new 6-litre W12 engine Bentley Bentayga Speed, a 2.5-tonne 4x4 that can reach 60 in less than 4 seconds, you can swank around London to your heart's content. tent without paying a single penny in ULEZ, doing roughly 14 miles to the gallon and belching out loads of CO2, which is not good for the planet. Now, I don't want to just pick on Bentley here. I'm going to read out a list of cars that would also be free from ULEZ whilst your person in their old Qashqai, Mondeo, Ford Focus, list your old car if you want to, is paying £12.50 a turn. The Rolls-Royce Cullinan. This is an absolutely huge... This makes a Bentley Bentayga look like a tiny little toy. It's so big. A Porsche Cayenne. Mm. They're a lot less ostentatious than they used to be. Still pretty big, fast SUV. A Lamborghini Urus. If you really want a fast SUV, this is the one to get to really show off. It's effectively a sports car on stilts. It's unbelievable. Packs a serious punch. Not great for the planet, but you won't have to pay ULEZ. Range Rover, it's the classic. If you want to drive around in a big SUV in London, the Range Rover is your classic choice. Or maybe you prefer a drop-top Ferrari, perhaps a California, for example. Or you're thinking that those are too ostentatious, so you'll just go for a very, very big BMW with a massive whacking grille on the front to show people that you are coming. That'll be your BMW X7. Or you want to go a bit sort of, well, these used to be old school money, right? The Mercedes G-Wagon. Now they're just a bit footballer gangster. Again, massive whacking great engine. Not great MPG. I mean, the aerodynamics on them aren't fantastic because they do look like a Tonka truck. They did used to be quite cool. I'm not sure they're as cool as they used to be, but I would still quite like one. We'll set you back more than £100,000, but you won't pay ULEZ. Or maybe you could go for an Aston Martin DBX. This is Aston Martin's take on the fast SUV, and it is now selling more than half of its cars as SUVs, James Bond's favourite sports car maker. Again, 158,000 of your English pounds, brand new, but you won't pay ULEZ.
Marvellous.
There will be some guy driving around in a £4,000 Qashqai who is having to pay it, though.
Yeah.
And this just doesn't sit right with me. I mean, it's somewhat amusing when you look at some of these cars secondhand, if you can track them down secondhand, they are actually advertised as ULEZ compliant. Although, as I said in my column, this may possibly be less amusing if you're the owner of the £4,000 Qashqai, who's seen its value plummet and when they're trying to sell it secondhand and is also having to find another £4,000 in order to get a ULEZ compliant family car. For classic cars, there is an exemption, but only if they're 40 years old or more. That misses out a huge chunk of classic cars, modern classics, and also misses out the opportunity for cars to turn into 40-year-old classic cars if it drives them off the street. It's harder to argue for a classic car because effectively a lot of these are just owned for fun rather than necessity. But there's lots of people who do own a classic as their only car in London, and they might be more likely to own a modern classic. And wouldn't our streets be a poorer place to be without the nice 1980s BMW 3 Series, a lovely E30 Series BMW, old Golf GTI, Peugeot 205 GTI, we all know those are close to my heart, yeah, a Mercedes SL, Porsche 944, Porsche 928, Porsche 968 or a 911, or even just a nice bog standard old-fashioned bread van VW Polo, just sitting there looking classy amongst all the old stuff. As I said, it's an admirable aim cleaning up the air we breathe, but I don't see how ULEZ being brought in the way that it's being brought in can be justified because it is so regressive. Effectively, if you can drop £150,000 on a brand new spanking huge SUV, or even just £40,000 on a brand new car, you are golden and you will not be paying ULEZ. But if you are tooling around in a car that's 10 years old, 20 years old, and is actually arguably better for the environment because its environmental cost has already been spread out over more years, then you will be paying it. And I also don't believe that people have totally twigged to this, because I said before on this podcast, there's a game you can play where you walk down an ordinary London street and you count the cars that are going to get hit by ULEZ. And it's not shifted a huge amount in the last couple of years. And I don't think all of those people are going to be happy to pay £650 a year to drive their car once a week. And it's coming in 3 months' time. And it's very easy for people to think this is London, whatever. Don't own a car. We shouldn't own a car in London. There are lots of people who do need to own a car in residential London. Or, well, don't move to London. Or London's a dump. Don't go there. But it's coming to a town or city near you because the government wants towns and cities to roll this kind of stuff out in the same way that it wants to get rid of our gas boilers. And I do refuse to believe that there couldn't be the opportunity for some form of residence discount, even like for just like the really quiet times in the evenings or the weekends or something like that.
I was just going to say, I've got a sort of extended family member who lives in a council property in Islington. And actually, she only learned to drive a few years ago. She's well in her 50s and has a sort of beat up car. And I was talking to her about this recently, and she really didn't know anything about it. And it's coming in October, and she really was clueless about. I was like, every time you drive from your home into Essex now, or well, from later in the year, you know, it's going to cost money. And she was like, wow. And I think she was quite taken aback at it. And Simon touched there, it's not just the London thing now. You know, we're going to be looking at these clean air zones coming into towns and cities across the country. And actually last month, Birmingham launched an £8 a day clean air zone. And there's figures out this week suggesting that in the first month, 44,000 drivers have been fined for not basically paying the charge. That's a lot of people that obviously didn't quite realize what was going on in Britain's second biggest city. So there's going to be a lot of this going on over the next few years, and it could hit a lot of people, especially in those urban areas.
And what will happen is, so in Birmingham, it is in only a very small central area. Compare it to the congestion charge zone or something in London, but it will spread out. The councils will spread it out because it does get money in. And although they're not allowed to make a profit on this stuff, they do like revenue raising stuff involving cars. Look at parking charges, etc. And they will push it out further. They'll watch what happens with ULEZ and they will push it out further. And then it will start to affect more people. And yes, I mean, it probably will improve air quality. That's what Transport for London says. They says, well, we have improved air quality, but it will definitely start affecting more people. And it is, as I said, deeply, deeply regressive. And the thing to bear in mind is once you go outside of London, public transport is woeful in this country.
Yes, I can concur with that, Simon. Now, investors are feeling rather bullish at the moment and in the mood for a bit of a bargain hunt. That's according to Schroders. As markets recover from the pandemic, value and quality stocks are in, but income and momentum are out. So what are the latest investing trends and what does it all mean, Simon? Simon, what's in Schroders' report? How do we hunt value? What do we mean by quality? And income and momentum are out?
Yeah, are out. Don't wear income or momentum this summer. That is out.
Because I thought I rather like the sound of income and generally.
Yeah, well, momentum's always good. So these are investing terms and people will hear these all the time. And Schroders has done a study where it's asked, you know, financial advisors what investors are keen to put their money into. And investors are keen to put their money into value stocks. This is stuff that is seen as cheap. And then also want quality. So that is companies with strong balance sheets. Now, ideally, if you can find an intersection of these two things, then you're going to do well because you've got a company that's cheap. Maybe it's for an external reason that might be about to change. Perhaps it's cheap because of lockdowns, coronavirus, etc. But it's got a strong balance sheet. An airline might be an example of this, although always be wary of investing in airlines. But a couple of the airlines actually do have quite strong balance sheets. And I think that I am correct in saying IAG, which is the BA owner, and Ryanair both have pretty strong balance sheets. But they've obviously been heavily beaten down by the fact that air travel has not been the flavour of the month for the past 2 years. And nobody's quite sure when air travel is going to be the flavour of the month again. So they could be poised for a rebound. Don't just take my word for this. Anybody listening to the podcast, please do your own research before investing in anything, blah, blah, blah. That's the thing that people want. They want value. They want quality because they've heard this thing about, like, basically the growth stocks are out. You want value. Growth companies are those which tend to grow their businesses and increase revenue at a faster rate than other firms, but they might make lesser profits. They're being less favored now because there is the thought that people are going to be less willing to pay up for this whilst you've got cheap value companies rebounding and making profits now rather than a promise of profit in the future. And also interest rate expectations have stepped up a gear, and that leads to a bit less cheap money, and cheap money tends to flow into the kind of growth stock kind of stuff. The growth investing story has obviously been very much dominated in recent years by the US tech stars. So, you know, name your company, Facebook, Apple, etc., Netflix, Zoom. UK listed examples would include something like Ocado, ASOS, Boohoo. And the other thing that people aren't so keen on is momentum. Momentum is basically working on the basis that stuff that goes up tends to continue going up, and is an observable phenomenon in trading and investing. But it has been the dominant one since the rebound from the coronavirus crisis began. And now the tide is turning a little bit against that, in, again, because of this search for cheap, beaten up companies. Income is targeting dividends, regular dividends. Now, I'm surprised that income is said to be out, because as far as I'm aware with investors, income is permanently in, because people love dividends. And actually, if you look at long-term returns, they compounded dividends over time are a key element of it.
Simon, just one thing. What do you expect for the next 12 months and beyond?
I don't know. I've given up on that. I'm never making predictions again in my life.
We had a Schroeder's report. I thought we'd have a Simon report as well. No.
I think that companies are reporting at the moment, and they look very favourable, mm-hmm. the company's reports, because you can compare. They often get compared to a year ago, and a year ago didn't look very good. So then a lot of companies are actually willing to compare to 2 years ago. And if they've actually flagged 2 years ago, it usually means they've done quite well. If they don't flag 2 years ago, you can tell that they probably haven't done that well. And some companies are reporting that they are doing better than they were 2 years ago. And I think we will see a strong recovery. I think there is definitely consumer appetite to spend. I think some of that will fizzle out. I don't know whether it will be self-sustaining enough to get us out of the low growth world that we've been in, and whether some of those cheap value companies have already got a lot of the recovery in the price. But I think if you can find the ones that will surprise you to the upside, as they say, which is basically continue to surprise you with better and better news, then you will do well. But do your own research and do it properly before you invest in individual shares.
All right, then. Now let's talk current accounts. Lads, I've done it, finally. It all started as a fresh-faced fresher, strolling into the White Ladies Road branch of HSBC in Bristol. Frankly, it took no more consideration than it was just the closest bank to my halls of residence. But this week, it all ended. As a slightly less fresh-faced 30-something-year-old, on my mobile, actually, I have ended, finally, my longest relationship ever. And I've switched. I will let you know how it goes. I had a choice, though. I had had enough, frankly, with my current bank. But about 250,000 Tesco Bank customers don't really have a choice, Lee. And they are looking for a new home after Tesco announced it'll close its current account operation from November. And before we get into that, firstly, Lee, Simon, have you switched?
Yeah, I've switched, Georgie. Yeah, so how did you not have a bank account before you started university? What did you do between... before then, you're just walking around with envelopes of cash.
I didn't have one.
I think I had a Santander savings account or whatever it was then. What did it used to be called? Abbey National.
I don't think I had a current account until I left school. I mean, I worked when I left school for a year. So I think I got one then. But even then, I committed the cardinal sin of going away and doing a snowboard season using a Barclay card as my main course of spending and taking money out of a cash machine with it, because I didn't know any better. And my dad didn't tell me any better either at the time. But yeah, I definitely don't think I had a current account. I might have had a savings book
account.
Got me thinking
though now, Lee, because I did have a job, so I don't know where my money was going. I must have had something. But either way, it wasn't a very long relationship because I started a new one when I went to university. I'll find that out. I don't know how, but I will. But either way, you've
confused. I'm in a similar boat to you. So when I left school, I opened a bank account with NatWest, because it was the one of only two banks in the town that I lived in Rochford in Essex. And the reason why I mention it's Rochford in Essex is because both of those branches are now shut. And they have this bank hub thing that feels like every single financial journalist has now descended onto Rochford at some point in the last few months to go and have a look at. And that bank hub is basically an old furniture shop, and it's one day it's HSBC, one day it's a Barclays, one day it's another bank, one day it's another bank, so people can go in. But I got lured in, and I'm sure we've mentioned this on the podcast before, with the Rail card which is always a good one for students. I was at university in London and I knew it would come in handy to get that discount. And I also worked a job which required me to get a train. So it all worked out for me. I made a nice little bit of savings on that. But then it wasn't working hard enough for me, Georgie. Okay. So 5 or 6 years ago, I used a switching service, which I think is a fantastic thing. 7-day switch thing, all direct debits moved, your salary, all that kind of thing. I moved to a bank that was offering a good bribe, cash, basically.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And
a few good of those around.
And good customer service, and I've been there ever since. But I have been toying with switching again, maybe.
Oh, yeah.
And actually, I think it's a real shame that people don't switch as much as they could, especially with that service being so good. And actually, there's a quote I saw in a story that we wrote about it this week saying that people are more likely to get divorced than they are to switch bank account, which is,
So, Lee, I have some considerations. I've got 5 days to wait until it properly goes through, so they inform me. By which stage my rent goes out the next day. Will that be okay?
It should be. Otherwise, you can complain.
Yeah, great. My other concern was I've learned my sort code and account number. You know, it's just so easy, and now I would have to.
Well, that's it. Actually, in terms of your rent, Georgie, I'm not sure. You might have to.
Might send them a little note. Just
you might have to check that out, because even though it depends if it's on a direct debit, I guess. It's on standard order. You'll have to check that out. I don't want to be responsible for you not paying.
That's all right. You wouldn't be. I wouldn't blame you, Lee. It's just, you know, it's the concerns that you think about when you change. But I had had enough, and I've gone for mobile only. Actually, I was reading your article after I'd switched, and it was one of the top four to move to. So I was rather pleased with that. So we're going to talk about Tesco then. What are they doing?
Well, I'll be honest, Georgia, this is no big surprise. And I'll tell you why surprise for a number of reasons. So firstly, they stopped new current account customers at the end of 2019. So people haven't been able to open a current account with Tesco Bank for a good year and a half anyway, almost 2 years. So the writing was kind of on the wall a little bit anyway. We've seen M&S Bank also shutter its current account customers this year. That's no longer, there's no current account at M&S Bank anymore. Supermarkets went on this real rampage into the financial services industry in the last sort of 10, 15 years in all sorts of financial products. Current accounts can be incredibly expensive product to run for people, and especially if you can't cross-sell them other products because they're not using your current account very much. And that's exactly what's happened at Tesco. Only 12% of those 213,000 customers use it as a primary account. I mean, that's 20 to 30 or 1,000 people using it. Everyone else was using it to put savings in or as a separate pot, or it was just dormant. So it was becoming a bit of a burden, I imagine, on Tesco Bank, and it was just pointless having it. You know, you're not making money out of it. People aren't going into overdrafts and all of that kind of thing. No, they've just decided to exit the market. So while 213,000 people sounds like a lot of people, when you narrow it down to the actual amount of people that use it as their primary account, you can see that really it's only those that are going to be looking for a new home. And Tesco have got a couple of options for customers, because you've got to make sure your balance is zero by the 30th of November. And if you are in your overdraft or whatnot, you know, you might need to clear it. So they're pushing people towards having a Tesco credit card potentially to push this money over to. They're also talking about customers can register for this Tesco Club Card Pay, which, reading between the lines, sounds like an app where you can collect club card points, but it will issue a debit card with it. So it's not strictly a current account, even though it does come with a debit card, and it's in a kind of trial phase. So there is that option too. Or you use the current account switching service, go and find somewhere better home for your cash. Now, there's not many bribes out there anymore. I think HSBC have just pulled their 100 quid offer, and there's not many. They keep coming in fits and bursts. A couple of the banks go in for this sort of 100, 125 quid to switch offer. You've got to act quick at the moment if you want one of those, because they seem to be pulled left, right and centre.
What I would say to that is it's nice, but don't make your decision based on that. Mine didn't offer me anything apart from the fact that I wasn't with my old one.
Exactly, yeah, and it might just be time to go and try pastures new. So, I mean, you know, you could try one of these new upstarts like Monzo or Starling, as you say. Some of them still offer a little bit of interest on current account balances, including nationwide, but it won't be an awful lot. I would really say it's worth just checking out customer service levels. And actually, all banks have to display that information on websites and in branch now. So you'll get a good indication as to who's good and who's not. And just go and test the water. It is a nuisance, though, for people, because even though we're talking about 25,000 odd that use it as a primary account, it still feels like, you know, that's your bank. That's who you've been with. That's who you trust. That's who you've been loyal with to. And now the rug's sort of pulled out from under your feet and you've got to find a new home. And all I would say to those people is the current account switching service is good. It is your friend and it is worth using. And if you do encounter any problems, you should be compensated for it.
Well, to look at the silver lining of that, that's, you know, 12% of 200 odd thousand that may never have used a switching service now have to use it. And actually, if they have a good experience, and by and large, they probably will, that'll be great. Then next time, if they see a better deal or they're not happy with their service, they'll go ahead and switch. They'll tell other people to switch. I'm just hoping mine will go fine so then I can tell people to switch. But is Barclays a good option? I mentioned there right at the start of the show, we said Avios points, not a lot out there. I don't think there's any other account that offers Avios points except Barclays at the minute. So if you are excited about getting your Avios points, then Barclays might be the one for you. But what's the catch, Lee?
I mean, again, we shouldn't make decisions on where we switch bank account by, you know, bribes and tricks and perks and things. You know, you've got to have a real all-round balanced product. You know, you want a good home for your cash. Barclays has been one of the losers, I would say, in the switching battle in the last sort of 5 years. You know, it's obviously a massive bank and it has lost a lot of customers to others that have switched away. This Avios deal, I should point... So Avios, first of all, is obviously just air miles, you know, and you can use it on BA and some other airlines. And people do religiously collect these maybe in the last 12 to 18 months, it's not been on the forefront of people's mind, you know, especially with holidays and flights and stuff kind of off the cards. And I reckon quite a lot of people are sitting on some chunky Avios points, not quite knowing what to do with them. But there are people out there, Georgie, that play this game absolutely brilliantly. You know, they will go and collect all of these points and they'll never pay for a flight. And they'll get upgrades and they'll fly around the world and they'll pay next to nothing. A lot of it is done on sort of like business travel, again, which has been hit. You know, people will be issued cards where they can collect Avios points through their business and things like that. And that's been hit quite a lot. So I get the feeling that Avios is on the attack for some more customers that are not doing that, you know, and looking for ways to make sure people are collecting these points. Now, with Barclays, they're doing this, but it's for its premier account. You've got to earn £75,000 a year or have £100,000 in an investment or another product with it. So that's quite a big hoop to jump.
Yeah.
But for a serious Avios collector, they might be earning that kind of money anyway, and they may be lured in with this 25,000 point bonus, which is pretty chunky. And in an age of where it doesn't feel like you're getting a lot else for your money, it's not bad. It does also have a monthly fee, this account, but it does kind of get wiped out by the Avios gains. But you've got to do the calculations, you've got to know the sums, you've got to have a real crunch. It's not as straightforward as what you think. And again, you shouldn't judge your sort of decision on it, but it's really worth having a look at and working out if it's worthwhile for you. I'm someone that's been collecting Avios points for a few years. And I've steadily built up a pot. I had an American Express card that was giving me Avios points and bonus points and all that kind of thing. I'm now sitting on a nice haul of points. My biggest issue with the whole thing, though, is the BA website and trying to find reward flights. Honestly, I feel like my head is just all over the place. It's just, I go and I look at it for 10, 15 minutes and I just tear my hair out. The whole website just needs such an overhaul. It's absolutely ridiculous. But there is a great website that I discovered in the last sort of month or two. I think it's rewardflightfinder.com. It's something like that. Have a Google. And basically, you can put in your airport, so London, all London airports, any destination that BA or whatever its partners fly to, and then it comes up with a calendar and it's got this really nice little graphics that shows you how many business class seats there are, how many economy seats there are, and it gives you a good gauge and then you can go back into BA, I would suggest doing that. I wouldn't be surprised if BA buy that off that, whoever's created that, because it's so much better than its own website. So, you know, it's all of these things, all of these things to consider. We spoke to Rob Burgess, who I've spoken to a lot over the years, who runs Head for Points, which is a fantastic website. It's always our go-to for these kind of air miles stories. And he thinks it is a good deal for high earning customers. And if you're into this kind of thing, mainly because of the bonus and the fact that you're getting this sort of premium banking service. So it's worth investigating. Yep. It's just worth pointing out. I thought it was interesting.
No, very good, Lee. Very good.
And since done that route.
Sage advice overall. All right, then, that's it for this week. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk and download the app. And if you have any comments or questions for the team or anything you'd like them to look into, Simon?
You can email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk, or you can tweet us at thisismoney, or you can come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast to join in the debate and read comments.
And if you like our podcast, why not rate us on iTunes? It helps people find us.